sovereignty, Saudi sovereignty, because actually MBS is exporting the dependence, more dependence on the Americans, because we all know that the Americans in the whole West Asia region, they only see the Israelis. And they have proven that no matter how important you become in the relations with us, no matter what are the services you provide us, there would...
no matter the trillions that you pay, Zionist
exactly.
Israel will always come up first.
Exactly. Zionist first for the Americans, whether it was Trump or any other U.S. president.
Well, he also was tying a bit of normalization attempts with the current relationship with the U.S., with the Gaza policy and the massive U.S. investments altogether, just tying them up with the normalization. Trump essentially forced Mohammed bin Salman into some sort of a transactional framework that obviously serves American optics more than Saudi interests. How does this reveal the Crown Prince's political vulnerability? And why does he still feel pressured to play along in in an issue that has shown over the past 2 weeks that the entire world now stands with Palestine? So he had a golden opportunity to actually stay there and say, look, this is a hill I'm ready to die on. I will support the Palestinian people. You have been killing them for the past 2 years. But still, he didn't use that card, and he is obviously falling for the pressure.
Well, I said before, as I said earlier, he is always, he knows that he is vulnerable, and in any moment he can be replaced. That's why when talking about normalization with the Zionists and playing a major role in the in Gaza or in South Lebanon, Donald Trump is telling him that you are nothing but an ATM machine. We want you to fund the reconstruction to take place in Gaza, probably in South Lebanon too, and also in Syria. But for MBS, he knows that to tighten his relations with the Americans, to have the security guarantees he wants, he has to walk on the bridge that passes through Tel Aviv that leads to Washington. That's why he is convinced culturally and, you know, on a strategic level, that his destiny and his political future is linked to the normalization. Of course, he has more some obstacles in the way because, you know, we are talking about Saudi Arabia, the country which brags about leading the Arab decision. As well as, you know, the resemblance of the two holy shrines in Mecca and Medina. So he cannot go into normalization without claiming to have something for the Palestinians. That's why when he was asked with Trump in the White House about the normalization and joining the so-called Abraham Accords, he again reiterated that something has to be made regarding the path that would lead into a Palestinian state. I think that MBS needs many things from Donald Trump. He is trying to use that I cannot go, but I'm willing to cooperate. So I believe that he is going to cooperate in Gaza and in South Lebanon, as well as in Syria, and probably in other countries, Arab countries like Yemen, for example. This proves how weak he is and how eager to gain more commitment, U.S. commitment, and guarantees for his own security and his own ruling.
Well, it's up to the future to show us if this is what he's going to have from Trump or not. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Murad, political commentator and writer at the Al-Akhbar Lebanese Daily. Thank you very much for your contribution. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about Lebanon's ceasefire that never was.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Since November 27 of last year, Zionist Israel has carried out continuous strikes across southern Lebanon, the Baqa, and even Beirut's Dahiyeh, just like what happened on Sunday's massacre, revealing how meaningless the word ceasefire becomes when one side enjoys unconditional Western protection. More details in the following report.
Since the supposed ceasefire of November 27, 2024, Zionist Israel has maintained an unbroken chain of assaults across southern Lebanon, the Baqa Valley, and even Beirut's suburbs known as Dahiyeh, a reality that exposes how meaningless the word ceasefire becomes when one side is granted total impunity. In the south, the strikes are relentless. Nabatiyeh, Kafr Amman, Jarma, Arab Salim, Humin Fawqa, Deir Zahrani, and areas stretching toward the Marja'iyun and the Aitarun are hit repeatedly. Air raids, drone strikes, artillery shells, the method varies, the pattern does not. These villages have become routine targets, absorbing the daily expression of Zionist Israeli military power. The Baqa Valley is not spared. Hirmil, Baalbek, and border areas are bombarded under the familiar pretext of weapons routes or Hezbollah positions. Each strike erases farmland, homes, and the fragile sense of stability that residents attempt to rebuild between bombardments. For farmers and families, the attacks are not operations. They are the systematic destruction of their livelihoods. Beirut's southern suburbs have also faced direct Israeli entity aggression. Dahiyeh, one of the most densely populated civilian areas in the country, has been targeted multiple times, including strikes that triggered mass evacuations, widespread panic, and major structural damage. The message is blunt. No area is off limits. Israeli entity bulldozers have pushed more than 100 meters into Lebanese territory in some southern locations, flattening land and entrenching military presence. Thousands of air, land, and naval violations have been recorded since the ceasefire. The casualty toll continues to rise, with nearly 200 killed and hundreds more injured, overwhelmingly civilians. These aren't isolated incidents or defensive reactions. They are part of a declared strategy. Senior Israeli entity figures, including Benjamin Netanyahu and Itamar Ben-Gvir, have openly discussed the necessity or inevitability of occupying southern Lebanon. When political leaders say the quiet part out loud, the military follows with action. Internationally, the response borders on endorsement. The United States of America and major European governments continue to grant Zionist Israel a de facto carte blanche, framing every strike as self-defense while ignoring the obvious, a continuous campaign of aggression in violation of Lebanese sovereignty and international law. Silence becomes permission. Permission becomes policy. For civilians in the south and Baqa, the consequences are not abstract. Homes collapse, roads crater, olive groves burn, and entire communities hover between displacement and devastation. The pattern paints a clear picture. The ceasefire exists only in diplomatic statements, not in the skies over Lebanon. This is a slow-motion war, one enabled, justified, and protected by the West, and one that lays bare Zionist Israel's long-announced ambition to reshape, pressure, and ultimately control the landscape of southern Lebanon.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ali Awad, a political commentator and university lecturer. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Ali. Now, Israeli entity leaders openly, including Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir, have openly spoken about reoccupying the southern part of Lebanon. How should these statements be interpreted in the broader context of Zionist Israel's long-term strategy toward Lebanon, and what message do they send to the entire Lebanese people?
These Israeli entity statements, these declarations by Israeli entity leaders, are nothing new. They are not the first of their kind. For years, and especially in recent months, we have repeatedly heard similar escalatory rhetoric. If we look back at the past, from the 1980s to the 1990s, and even into the period after the year 2000, we find this kind of discourse deeply embedded in Israeli entity political language. But what truly matters in the context you're referring to are the circumstances under which these statements are being made. We are talking about extremely difficult conditions for Netanyahu and for other Israeli entity leaders. Just a few days ago, we saw Netanyahu in the Knesset, under pressure, being questioned and heavily criticized. At this very moment, the committee that was formed is still investigating a series of failures tied to Netanyahu on October 7, along with other legal and political files that have become a burden on the Israeli entity leadership. From this perspective, we can understand why these statements are being issued and why this escalation is directed at Lebanon and at the region. Whenever Israeli entity leaders find themselves trapped in a new crisis, they fall back on more media escalation, more psychological pressure, and more propaganda aimed at the Lebanese people, the Lebanese state, and Lebanese authorities. What I want to highlight in response to your question is that several recent studies have been published, and we know the Israeli entity military relies heavily on strategic, security, and military research. In the latest of these studies, the security and military establishment advised the political leadership to exercise caution and restraint, urging them not to be swept up by the political grandstanding that some Israeli entity politicians are engaging in. These security institutions have recommended avoiding escalatory steps such as occupying territory in the south or seizing land in other parts of Lebanon, because such actions could impose a heavy cost on the occupying entity, one that Zionist Israel is not in a position to bear at this sensitive moment. Even though we see certain Israeli entity escalations through airstrikes across various regions, there are internal scientific and military recommendations against expanding operations any further. According to Zionist Israeli assessments, the statements made by Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem and other military leaders must be taken seriously, particularly regarding Hezbollah's ongoing recovery and strengthening on the security, political, military, organizational, economic, and social levels. These assessments stress that such warnings should not be dismissed, and that the surprises Hezbollah may be preparing under its strategic silence could be deeply harmful to the occupation in the long run.
And I think this is what we are seeing with the strikes, the continuous strikes on Nabatiye, on Hirmil, on Baalbek, and even Dahye. On Sunday, there was a massacre in the Har Tahrik area in Dahye. This is all happening under an official ceasefire. What does this pattern of violations reveal about the nature of Israeli entity military doctrine, and why does Zionist Israel feel comfortable escalating under the umbrella of Western diplomatic protection?
At this point, we must consider the angle from which the Israeli entity views Lebanon. Zionist Israel looks at Lebanon through a Western lens, specifically through the interests of Western powers, and foremost among them, the United States. What the U.S. administration wants from Lebanon is to shape the overall mood, politically, socially, and within the resistance environment, in a direction that is hostile to the resistance. From this perspective, we can understand Zionist Israel's escalations and the continuous airstrikes that never cease, whether in the south or in the Bekaa. On Sunday, there was a massive strike on Bir al-Abed in the southern suburbs. All these escalations aim to increase pressure on the Lebanese state and on the resistance's social base, in hopes of turning public opinion against the resistance, pushing Lebanese society towards the question, what is the point of the resistance? What is the point of its weapons? Why do we want Hezbollah in this environment? Every layer of pressure is designed to feed into this narrative, and it is expected that such pressures will continue to intensify in the coming days and weeks, without necessarily leading to an open war. Because, as I mentioned earlier, Zionist Israel does not want to enter a full-scale war, neither a comprehensive confrontation nor a repeat of the 66-day war of last year. Zionist Israel is calculating carefully and is fully aware of the heavy costs such a war would impose. Here, it is crucial to highlight that the U.S. administration plays a central role in giving the Israeli entity the green light to pursue this strategy. Washington favors this military pressure campaign while simultaneously applying political and economic pressure. For example, just a few days ago, when a large delegation from the U.S. Treasury arrived in Lebanon, they went up to Baabda Palace and met with President General Joseph Aoun. Their main file was how to dry up Hezbollah's financial resources and cut off its funding channels. If this indicates anything, it shows the American pressure being applied financially and economically, on top of the endless American delegations that have been visiting Lebanon since the ceasefire, meeting with the three presidents and various Lebanese leaders. The focus of all these meetings has revolved around one topic, the dollar. Whether with Morgan Ortegas, Thomas Barak, or other U.S. officials tasked with handling the Lebanon portfolio. And these pressures will continue and intensify in the coming days, according to the political realities and the information available on the ground.
Well, the pressing question at the moment, and we just have a minute and a half left, Dr. Ali, From Hezbollah's perspective, how does Zionist Israel's continuous bombardment reshape the rules of engagement along the Lebanon-occupied Palestinian border? I mean, what will Hezbollah do if this escalates? What will this mean to the future of deterrence?
The answer to this question can be drawn directly from Netanyahu's speech at the United Nations. We all remember what Netanyahu said as he tried to showcase the so-called strengths and victories that the occupying entity claims to have achieved throughout the recent war, specifically from October 7 until today. He spoke at length about various issues and milestones. Even though he failed to convince the audience sitting before him, he continued speaking until he reached a critical strategic point, one that directly answers your question. He stated that the resistance movements in the region, particularly Hezbollah in Lebanon, now stand as the main obstacle to negotiations and to advancing the so-called peace process in the Middle East. He said these resistance movements are the primary barrier to Zionist Israel's grand project in the region. This clearly indicates that the true winners of the war are these very movements, still standing, still resilient, still capable of confrontation and maneuver. All the Israeli entity pressure campaigns, all the massacres and crimes, all the confrontations with the resistance, the killing of children, and the destruction of homes in Lebanon and across the region, none of it achieved the desired objectives. Zionist Israel failed to reach the strategic points it sought. Therefore, it is simply not true that the balance of power in the region has tilted towards the U.S. administration and Zionist Israel. The evidence shows otherwise. And more importantly, anyone building their illusions on the idea that the balance has shifted to Washington and planning their next steps, whether in political schemes, electoral alliances, or regional projects, will inevitably find themselves disappointed. In conclusion, the open battle will not end. The will of the people is free and enduring, and in the coming days, years, and defining moments, it will become clear who truly shapes the course of this struggle and who will set the strategic direction for the region at large.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ali Awada, who is a political commentator and also a university lecturer, for joining us to discuss this very pressing matter in Lebanon. Thank you very much for your time and your contribution, Dr. Ali. Now, ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 36th verse of this surah.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَإِلَى مَدْيَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمِ اعْبُدُوا اللَّهَ وَارْجُوا الْيَوْمَ الْآخِرَ وَلَا تَعْثَوْا فِي الْأَرْضِ مُفْسِدِينَ
And to Madian we sent their brother Shu'aib. And he said, O my people, worship Allah and expect the last day, and do not commit abuse on the earth, spreading corruption.
So, dear listeners, now that you have listened to this 36th verse, وَإِلَى مَدْيَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا, and you were probably with us in the previous episodes, we mentioned that the story of Lut was how it was unfolded, actually. And now, next to the story of Lut and his people, the stories of other people, such as the people of Shu'aib, the people of Ad and Thamud also the story of Qarun and Pharaoh come forth. So, at first, in this 36th verse, the Almighty Allah says, وَإِلَى مَدْيَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا And to Madian, we did send their brother Shu'aib. We might have mentioned this repeatedly before. The application of the word brother is very important. وَإِلَى مَدْيَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا What does this word denote? This word, brother, refers to the utmost love and affection of these prophets unto their people, and it shows the lack of seeking domination over them. These prophets had often relation with their people too, so it was as if this prophet was coming from the very people themselves. They had probably lived among their people. Everybody somehow knew who their prophet was, and they felt he's like a brother to them. That's how the prophets were, and that's how actually we must be if we are trying to get close to the nation. Anyway, Madian, وَإِلَى مَدْيَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا The word Madian, Madian is a city in the west-south of Jordan, which is called Mu'an today. And it is located in the east of Aqaba Gulf, where Shu'aib and his people actually lived in that time. Now, like other great divine prophets, Shu'aib began his invitation from belief in origin and resurrection, which are the foundation of any divine religion. So the verse continues, فَقَالَ يَا قَوْمُ He said, O my people, اُعْبُدُ اللَّهِ وَرْجُ الْيَوْمَ الْآخِرِ Worship Allah, and look you for the last day. So, why does this prophet start his actually invitation from this actually standpoint? It says, اُعْبُدُ اللَّهِ Worship Allah, وَرْجُ الْيَوْمَ الْآخِرِ Belief in origin causes man to feel constant observation from the side of Allah upon his deeds. And belief in resurrection, actually, وَرْجُ الْيَوْمَ الْآخِرِ This causes the man of the great court where everything of man will be dealt with entirely. So, belief in these two great principles will certainly have an extraordinary effect in training and improvement of man. And that's an important point.
وَإِلَى
Oh, So, brothers and sisters, regarding this 36th verse, we said that we are actually going to the story of other people, such as people of Shu'aib, Ad, Thamud, and Qarun, etc. So, after the story of Lut came forth this story. Now, we said that Prophet Shu'aib started, Ya Qawm, Ubudu Allah, Warju Al-Yawm Al-Akhir. Believe in Allah, worship Allah, and look for the last day. Now, we understand that monotheism and resurrection are at the top of the godly invitation of the divine prophets. And if you see any kind of prophet that is not in the very first place, first and foremost, inviting to Allah, monotheism and resurrection, you can come to the conclusion that he is not actually a prophet and is only claiming to have prophetic aspects. The servitude unto Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the belief in origin and resurrection both are the same preparation for separation from corruption. Because continuing it, وَرْجُ الْيَوْمَ الْآخِرِ, and look for the last day, it says, وَلَا تَعْثَوْ فِي الْأَرْضِ مُفْسِدِينَ, and do not act corruptly in the land making mischief. Now, this is the third command of Shu'aib. This is an inclusive, practical order which envelops all social programs. So, do not act corruptly in the land making mischief. Now, la ta'lu fil ardi mufsidin. The word corruption has a very vast meaning, and it actually encompasses any kind of vice, disturbance, destruction, maybe deviation and transgression. And the opposite point to it is righteousness and reconciliation in the concept of which the whole constructive programs are gathered. So, these aspects that we mentioned, these multi-dimensional, actually, instructive points covering ifsad and mufsid, and standing in the opposite side of it, would make it for us actually clear that these are the results of belief in Allah and belief in resurrection. The Quranic term wala ta'lu is derived from al in the meaning of to make mischief. So the difference with that is that this meaning is mostly used in relation of ethical corruption. So actually mentioning the Quranic word mufsidin after it is for emphasis. Now I think we are done with this 36th verse. And we'll be moving on to the next, continuing this story of the Prophet later on. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me.
You raise your tired hands toward the sky, and the dark night lights up as you praise God. Your tears rain on your hijab and this cold air is filled with the fragrance of jasmine flower. Come and walk again in our troubled streets and lanes, and heal the scars of our city with your sense of heaven. Oh, Father.
Bazaar.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to see how they help advance various industries and explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures.
The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages.
In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative high-tech productions for exports.
While I take a quick little break here, you go and watch this next segment. I'll be back shortly. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it.
Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these.
The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatin capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients.
So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amounts of those, they bring it to the production line.
Perhaps the biggest challenge in the production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1,000,000th of a gram. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
What they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use a lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula. And that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Till next time, take care and bye-bye. That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Boaz Earth team, thank you for tuning in, and bye for now. Until then.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Let's listen to it. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, that is the actual word of God. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims, literally meaning the recitation. The Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Surah Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. The surah, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions. Now we go for the translation of this holy surah. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, praised be Allah, Lord of two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. We start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. They will be followed by Minbar. The program covers speeches on various subjects by very well-known Islamic scholars and orators. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Quran Quest. If you want to know more about the Holy Quran, then this program is definitely for you. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Daral Chanoub. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Daral Chanoub in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment. And they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books. For example, a book from the 1980s in German language from Rastan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the kind of we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after the state, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr zu
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking
even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
Pro-justice demonstrators supporting Palestine Action's co-founder Huda Amouri taking the British government to court in the first ever judicial review of a proscribed group.
This is the culmination of a really concerted effort and a campaign over about 5 years to completely crush protest laws in this country, which means completely crush the fundamentals of democracy in this country.
Over 3 days, the High Court is examining whether the British Interior Ministry, known as the Home Office, followed lawful procedure when banning the group in July this year. Last month, the government tried but failed to block the case altogether.
I'm appalled at the fact that genocide, the crime of crimes, is being swept under the rug in favor of the British state's geopolitical and economic interests. And we're familiar with this. I mean, obviously, I'm coming from Germany, where we are the German government is the second largest weapons deliverer to Israel. And the British state also has, the British Empire has interests that they are looking to protect. They are threatened by Palestine Action and by nonviolent direct action.
The hearing follows nationwide civil disobedience. The outcome of this court battle will have consequences for thousands of campaigners like these arrested for holding up these signs. Before the ban, which was issued under terrorism legislation, Palestine Action had targeted the UK-based sites of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. They also sprayed red paint into the engines of two military planes they accused of refueling aircraft involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
The prescription has come because of a lot of pressure from outside interests, the military industrial complex, political lobbyists, military lobbyists, both internally to the UK and externally.
The activists who carried out those actions are held in remand. Six are now on an open-ended hunger strike.
It can't be denied that this is all part of the same fight, and it's all inextricably linked together. If the deprescription appeal is successful, then it will prove to everybody that this is not a terrorist organization, and there's no justification to keep people held in prison without trial on terrorist charges.
In a dramatic last-minute twist, the judge adjudicating the case was replaced with a three-judge panel, including one that voted in favor of the UK sales of the F-35 parts to Israel, fueling accusations of a stitch-up among campaigners.
Beyond the legal arguments, the campaigners here say this case exposes something deeper, and that is the length to which the British government is prepared to go to protect the Israeli regime and its interests, even if that means stretching the law to silence those who challenge them. Saeed Purizep, London.
As Israel's deadly onslaught in Gaza continues, any notion of a ceasefire exists in name only, according to Francesca Albanese. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories told a European Parliament hearing on Tuesday via video link that relatively few countries have stood up for Palestinians.
The rest have been bending backward and forward to comply with the diktat of the United States, including European countries and European Union.
Albanese is scathing about the US-driven plan for Gaza's future, especially the reconstruction proposals.
The reconstruction plan not only is wrong as it's planned, because it's planned without the Palestinians and while the bombing and the shooting and the starving are still ongoing, but also because Gaza is a crime scene.
Several lawmakers expressed anger that Palestinians are not being placed at the center of discussions about Gaza's future.
It's so striking, the current EU reaction to the 28-point plan regarding Ukraine, where the EU very clearly said there's no plan without the Ukrainians.
Once again, fresh calls were made for the EU to halt all trade with the Israeli regime. There have been any number of debates and events in the European Parliament relating to the plight of Palestinians, but they effectively come to nothing.
This is because any potential sanctions don't even get as far as here, the EU Council. And that is because the European Commission knows they'll be blocked by certain member states.
Analysts argue that the EU has now taken a back seat on foreign policy, with the United States firmly in control.
I mean, the whole situation with the European Union in the Middle East now